I personally think if you play it out, that means that machines have solved every social problem we have, from disease to climate change, and that we have the luxury of spending all day deepening our connection to other people, engaging in self-improvement, or, you know, without me telling you what to do with your day, enjoying the metaverse.
What comes to mind when you think of artificial intelligence? Is it something along the lines of HAL from the movie 2001: The Space Odyssey? Artificial intelligence has been around since the 1950s, when Alan Turing first queried whether machines think. Now its market size is around $328 billion. I'm Lise McLeod, and Professor Ryan Abbott joins me today to talk about his book, The Reasonable Robot, where he argues that the law should not discriminate between AI and human behavior, and proposes a new legal principle that will ultimately improve human well-being. Hello, Ryan. Welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here today and to have you talk to us about artificial intelligence.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
How about we start at the beginning? If you could outline for us your definition of artificial intelligence from your book, The Reasonable Robot. You also cover the concept of whether artificial intelligence thinks or not. Could you please also expand on that?
Yes, happy to. And, you know, it's interesting that 60 years after people have started using the term or so, people still have very different views of what AI is, which is interesting academically, but also problematic when you get to making regulations around AI and people are talking about different things. And if people are having trouble defining AI, they're having a really hard time talking about artificial intelligence generated inventions and meaning the same thing. For me, I think of AI very functionally, similar to its original definition, as a machine or an algorithm that does something we would ordinarily expect cognition or human cognition for. And that could be something as simple as operating a cash register to something as complex as driving a car or finding a new drug. But I think about AI in terms of what it does functionally, not how it is structured or operates. This gets into, too, some longstanding philosophical questions about whether what machines do are similar to what people do when they complete the same sorts of tasks, whether machines, in other words, think like a person, or whether what machines do is really very different than what a person does. I mean, clearly machines don't do exactly the same thing a person does, but I rather take the view of Alan Turing, who wrote a paper in the 1940s on this and said, you know, we really don't know what it means to think, and it doesn't really matter that much if what you want out of some system, you know, particularly a legal system, is to promote some sort of behavior. You know, for example, with patent law, we want more socially valuable innovation to be created. It really doesn't matter to me whether, if a machine is to come up with that innovation, whether it does something very similar to how a person innovates or something really very different. You know, in other words, it wouldn't matter to me whether an invention comes from a person, a group of people, a room full of monkeys on typewriters, or a computer. You know, if we're looking for a new antibody to treat COVID-19, we just want to promote some sort of behavior that results in that sort of outcome. So for me, the fascinating philosophical question of whether machines think is less relevant to us creating legal systems to promote social benefits from artificial intelligence.
For you, it's less relevant, but it's seemingly relevant to the systems currently in place. How is artificial intelligence functioning in relation to creativity and innovation at the moment?
Well, it may matter to some of the systems, although, frankly, some of these issues are still being worked out. So, for example, people have claimed to use machines to make creative works that would traditionally attract copyright attention or subsistence of copyright, like a new painting or a song. Since the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, today you can go to a variety of commercial tools online, press a couple of buttons, and out comes something that really appears very creative. You could ask, about that process, or you could think about that process in two sorts of ways. You know, one is something functionally creative being made by a machine, or two, you know, do machines go through the traditional way these tests have been phrased by courts? For example, you know, are things happening in the mind of a machine? If you want to think about it in its more philosophical sense, that might prevent something like copyright from existing. The U.S. Copyright Office, for example, holds that a computer-generated work, something made without a traditional human author, can't get protection. And they base that policy on very old Supreme Court case law that says, you know, things that get copyright protection are things that come from the mind of an author. And the Copyright Office says, well, machines don't have minds, so therefore they can't have copyright. And neither do monkeys, for that matter, if we have time for that. The United Kingdom, for example, has a law that explicitly provides protection for computer-generated works, and they do not get into questions of, you know, originality or what is in a machine's mind if you were to create an analogy for something like that. So the way you think about these things can impact the sorts of real-world outcomes from AI behavior.
In the book, you mentioned the Siemens case study, where they were unable to file for protection on multiple artificial intelligence-generated inventions because a natural person couldn't be identified as an inventor. You state that meanwhile, patent offices have likely been granting patents on AI-generated inventions for decades. Could you please talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, the Siemens case study was one that I became aware of from attending the WIPO first conversation on AI and IP, which is a good reason why one should always attend WIPO events. But the chief IP counsel of Siemens explained to the group that they had an industrial design generated from an artificial intelligence that they wanted to patent, and none of the people involved in it were willing to list themselves as inventors. Essentially, they felt that they had done nothing requiring inventive skill, and it would be wrong for them morally to be inventors on it. They had an AI that optimized industrial components. They gave it publicly available information. They told it what they were looking for, which was well known, and the AI spit out a design that was obviously valuable. There's a lot of interesting issues with that. The commercial issue is that Siemens thus doesn't get a patent, and now would have a hard time commercializing that product because once they sold it once, anyone could copy it and Siemens couldn't stop them. But it isn't just, you know, the moral feelings of engineers. In the United States, if you list the wrong inventor on a patent, that patent becomes unenforceable if you did it, you know, without doing it in good faith. And if you do it deliberately and accurately, it opens you up to criminal sanctions. So, you know, on the patent front, as well as the copyright front, you have issues with whether intellectual property rights can exist at all, as you have machines doing human-like sorts of things, and a whole variety of other interesting issues that this sets off throughout, you know, even the way IP applies to natural persons. Now, people, you know, looking at machines making creative and inventive things was part of my research agenda. And as part of that, I spoke to people who in the 1990s, 80s, and even 70s claimed they were having machines do the thing that traditionally makes a person an inventor. And when they did that, they unanimously said, you know, our lawyers said, you don't want to say that. Just say you're the inventor. There's no rule about this. It's fine. Otherwise, you're not going to get a patent. And so that's what they did. Interestingly, Lord Justice Burse in the United Kingdom, who we may get to in a moment, spoke a week ago at a conference and mentioned that he had had a case involving an AI-generated work about a decade ago involving car brake components. You know, both parties had agreed that the design essentially just came out of an AI, but the existence of patent protection for an AI-generated work wasn't at issue in that case.
Am I understanding correctly that in order to get a patent for an invention produced by artificial intelligence, then the listed inventor still needs to be a human?
Well, these are all somewhat open questions that aren't harmonized right now in different jurisdictions. And some jurisdictions at the moment are taking the position that if you have an AI make some inventive thing that would normally get a patent, it can't be protected at all because you don't have a traditional human inventor. Other jurisdictions have said the manner in which an invention is made shouldn't interfere with getting a patent, which is the way we have traditionally done things, but are struggling to figure out, well, how exactly this works once machines are doing that inventive part of all this. Inventorship and entitlement issues vary by jurisdiction. Sometimes they're not really that well formalized, and they aren't necessarily harmonized. You know, it is usually the case that an inventor is the first owner of a patent, but not always. For example, in the United Kingdom, inventions first belong to employers when something is done within the scope of employment and never owned by inventors at all. In fact, it is the case that most patents are not owned by natural persons or inventors. They're owned by artificial persons in the form of corporations. So companies own the vast majority of patents, and a fairly small number of companies own a fairly large number of patents. You know, companies like IBM and Siemens and Huawei. So the idea that an inventor wouldn't own their patent is an old one, not a new one. But if a machine does invent something, it can't own a patent because it doesn't have legal personality or the ability to own property. It also wouldn't really make sense to have the machine own a patent because it wouldn't care about getting a patent and it couldn't exploit a patent. Now, you could change a law to give a machine a right. Again, that isn't something unprecedented. Lots of companies have rights. You know, you could give a self-driving car an insurance policy, for example. But I think it still doesn't really make a lot of sense. You know, it makes a lot more sense to have the person owning the AI or the company owning the AI own any patentable inventions that come out of it. And that's pretty consistent with both the way patents work with humans and the way that property works generally. So, for example, if I own a 3D printer and it makes me a beverage container, I own that beverage container. If I own an AI that makes a design for a beverage container, no reason I shouldn't own that design. At least that is our argument right now in terms of who should own this sort of thing.
In the book, you outline how artificial intelligence can safeguard human moral rights. Could you expand on that for us?
Sure. Well, if we're back to the patent context, there's two broad sorts of categories of rights people think about with patents. You know, one is economic rights. And in places like the United States or the United Kingdom, that's very much considered the dominant motivation behind patents. And patents do three things. They incentivize people to invent, they encourage people to disclose information, and they encourage people to commercialize new products. You know, so for example, if you were a pharmaceutical company, if you invent a new cure for COVID-19 and you want to get it approved by a drug regulatory authority, that sort of thing takes a lot of time and money. And without a patent or something kind of like a patent, you may not be able to recoup your investment in that if you don't have intellectual property protection. So this patent encourages you to invest in hiring research scientists to find new things, to publish things that you would otherwise keep as confidential information, and then to invest in getting something like a drug approved. And that really works the same whether you are hiring a team of people to do that or employing, so to speak, an AI to do that sort of thing. The other bucket of rights people associate with patents are moral rights. And, you know, this is generally the reason that you have inventors listed at all. For example, when a company owns something, although not every jurisdiction requires that. Israel, for example, doesn't require an inventor to be listed. But if I invent something for my university, I want to be listed on that patent. And at least that is a moral right of acknowledgement that, you know, says to the world, I invented this thing. And it, you know, can also have economic benefits for me for signaling my productivity, for example, to future employers. It is also possible that I get some sort of financial benefit from being an inventor, either because of a contract I have with my employer, or in jurisdictions like the European Union, there are rules that inventors can get, you know, essentially some financial benefit from very successful patents. Now, if you have an AI invent something, you have a couple options about how you might list an inventor. if I own an AI that invents 10,000 new drugs, for instance, I could try and list myself as an inventor on all of those things. And if I did that, it would make me the most prolific pharmaceutical researcher of all time. But it wouldn't really be credit that I deserved if all I was doing was telling an AI to solve a problem. You know, by contrast, if an AI invents something, listing it as an inventor would keep someone from claiming credit for work they haven't done. And it would prevent the dilution and diminishing of legitimate human ingenuity. It would also be transparent to the public about how an invention was made. And it would facilitate, you know, claims of entitlement or ownership by establishing a ownership structure with what AI solved something.
I think this would be a good time for you to share how you've been testing this system with your own artificial intelligence project.
Sure. So I and a group of patent attorneys filed for two patents for inventions made by an AI under circumstances such that we didn't have a traditional human inventor, at least in our opinion, not according to US or UK law, although that does vary by jurisdiction. And we did this for a few reasons. One was over the course of several years of me working on the project, this had gone from an issue that people sometimes found vaguely interesting to one that certain companies saw as a significant problem for them. And these were largely companies whose business model in some way was having AI come up with patentable new things, always with people somehow in the mix there, but often in ways where it would be difficult or in ways where it could be difficult to put a finger on someone and say, well, that person's an inventor, you know, not these other people. And so there was this unanswered question, because there had never been a case on this, which was, well, if you don't have a traditional human inventor, what do you do about that? And can you even get a patent? We filed these two patents in the United Kingdom Patent Office and the European Patent Office. And we did that because they would examine them without looking at inventorship for up to 18 months. So they examined the patents and they found that they were substantively patentable, which meant they were new, they had an inventive step, and they were useful. And generally, if a patent has those, or if a application has those characteristics, you get a patent. I could have then put my name on all of them and we would have had a bunch of patents and no one would have thought twice about this, at least until you tried to sue under one of them. But we could come back to that. So we then corrected the inventorship and said, well, we don't have a human inventor for this. A machine made this. And those two offices then denied those applications on a formalities basis. And we filed them in 15 other jurisdictions around the world. And they had been denied by the US, the UK, Europe, Germany, and Australia in final decisions of patent offices. And all of those decisions are currently under judicial appeal.
I admire your perseverance, Brian.
Well, the machines are very patient. And it has, you know, we have already had some interesting decisions on this. So while those five offices rejected them, and while we have 11 offices still either thinking about them or in some process of dealing with them, we received a patent in South Africa in July, and the AI, which in our case is named Dabis, is listed as the inventor on that patent. And the owner of the AI, Dr. Stephen Thaler, is listed as the owner of the patent. So the patent went to the person owning the AI, to Dr. Thaler, but the AI is listed as the inventor. And again, we argued this is the right way to handle something like this, to be transparent about how invention occurred, and to keep someone from taking credit for work they haven't done. You know, but ultimately, if you let the person who owns the AI own the patent, it encourages them to invest in making and using inventive machines to solve socially useful problems. And ultimately, again, coming back to our first topic, you know, what we want as a society out of a patent system is largely more socially valuable innovation, whether that's cleaner energies or cures for diseases or faster vehicles. And some of that, particularly in the future, is going to increasingly come from having machines deeply involved in that process. 3 days after that, the Federal Court of Australia and Justice Beach wrote a 41-page reasoned decision holding essentially to the same extent that there's no reason one shouldn't be able to get a patent on an AI-generated invention, that there's no reason why an AI can't be listed as an inventor, And at least in our case, that Dr. Thaler had the clearest claim of entitlement to owning that. But the denials have been upheld so far in the U.S., where it's now been appealed to the Federal Circuit, which is the intermediate federal court. And they were recently upheld, the denials, by the U.K. Court of Appeal, although that court split with Justice Burse, who I mentioned previously, holding that there should be no prohibition on patenting this sort of thing. The other two judges disagreed, and we're now seeking leave to appeal with the Supreme Court.
We will certainly be watching to see how this progresses for all of you. Can we talk a little bit about another part from the book and how artificial intelligence could change the standard of the skilled person? Could you expand on what is a skilled person in patent law and how that could potentially evolve with artificial intelligence? In what direction do you think AI could take it?
Sure. In some sense, well, let me start with the standard. So there are a number of requirements you have to meet to get a patent, but the most significant one tends to be that your invention has to be non-obvious to a skilled person in your field. So something has to be new, something has to be industrially applicable or useful, but it almost always is. And you have to imagine that if you had essentially your average researcher in your field and they saw your invention, they would think that it was inventive and not obvious. And that obviously is a very challenging test to do because it is a bit more subjective than the other tests. But that's the primary way that most jurisdictions determine whether or not what you have done is worthy of getting a patent, because patents have social costs and we don't want to grant them for any advancement. You know, we want to grant them for advancements, economically speaking, that wouldn't have come about or would have come about much slower without having this patent incentive. Now, that skilled person depends on what field you're in. So it could be kind of a regular person if we are looking at a very simple sort of invention, you know, for something around the house that makes something easier. If we're looking at chemical engineering or, you know, petroleum engineering, then you're looking at a very highly trained person who has a deep knowledge of literature in that field. And this standard evolves over time. So in Europe, for example, we have already decided that the skilled person may be a team of people, where it is standard in some areas that research is done by groups of people. And obviously, to a group of people, more will be obvious than would be obvious to a single person, right? And the better trained someone is and the more educated, the more will be obvious to them. Now, AI, to me, has already entered the picture. And in fact, I think already that sometimes the skilled person may be a skilled team of people using AI, because AI does two things that make more obvious. On the one hand, it gives people access to more prior art or existing information. So if you're looking to design a new chemical, you know, as a catalyst in a oil manufacturing facility or an oil processing facility, you might not be looking at culinary science. But if you have an AI that's, you know, providing input for you researching in this area, it might be pulling information from everywhere. And so you get basically a superhuman amount of information. And the other thing it does is it gives people certain problem-solving capabilities that they don't otherwise have, like pattern recognition in large data sets could be trivial for AI, but very difficult for a person. And so in some sense, as the facts change on the ground and people start using AI more, this will start making it harder to get patents on things. In the future, when AI is not just sort of inventing occasionally, but has become the standard way that problems are solved in a field. So for example, let's say COVID-25 comes along, and instead of Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson and Moderna going to large teams of people to find new vaccines, they all just use an AI, present it with a pathogen, and say, now, what vaccine should we use? Well, then the skilled person has effectively become a skilled person using an inventive machine, or maybe just an inventive machine. And to that inventive machine, a lot more is going to be obvious because it does a better job at researching than a person, at least if we are in a world where machines have replaced people at doing that. And I don't think that's anywhere right now, but it may well be the case in the not too distant future, at least in certain areas where machines have these natural advantages. for example, optimizing some sorts of industrial components or for finding some new chemicals or repurposing new chemicals as medicines. In some sense, though, that is not connected to the inventorship issue because skilled persons are explicitly not inventors, because to inventors, a lot more would be obvious than would be obvious to skilled persons.
You also mentioned that there's potentially no end of the sophistication of artificial intelligence, and that it may be difficult for a person alone to come up at some stage with anything that is not obvious. I would like to highlight what you mentioned in the book, that artificial intelligence may one day greatly alter the current patent system as we know it, but that this should not be a cause for concern. Could you please develop that idea a little bit for us?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of concepts in computer science. You know, one is the idea of general artificial intelligence, and one is the idea of super intelligence. The idea of a general artificial intelligence is that right now what we have is narrow artificial intelligence. We have AI that does certain tasks. So, you know, Google's DeepMind or Alphabet's DeepMind has an AI that could beat any human being in a game of Go, and it plays Go better than anything has ever played Go in human history. You know, but that Go playing AI couldn't, you know, design a better brake pad or, you know, counsel you on your medication usage. It just does that one thing. There is a theory that we will develop a machine that won't necessarily think like a person or be like a person, but that could do any intellectual task a person could do. So, you know, it could operate a cash register, drive a car, and make a painting, just depending on what you ask it to do. And if we do ever get that AI, and experts are divided on this, but most of them seem to think we'll have it this century, the first thing you might ask it to do would be to improve its own programming. And it could do that hypothetically at a, you know, exponential pace, such that in the not too distant future from having general artificial intelligence, you have a super intelligent AI that could not only really do anything, it could solve the problems we can imagine and the ones we can't. And at that point, you wouldn't really need a person to do anything because machines would so dramatically outcompete us. Now, that's been explored a bit in the computer science and philosophy literature and so forth, but not so much in the patent literature. If we do ever have a super intelligent AI, everything will be obvious to a super intelligent AI, which will effectively be the skilled person. So no, you really couldn't get patents anymore. And that would be an okay outcome because the cost of innovation would be trivial. And to the extent that you do need some further incentive for some sorts of things like getting new drugs approved, we might have to rely on other sorts of mechanisms like providing a period of market exclusivity for protected drugs. You know, some people view that as a dystopia where people are out of work. I personally think if you play it out, that means that machines have solved every social problem we have, from disease to climate change, and that we have the luxury of spending all day deepening our connection to other people, engaging in self-improvement, or, you know, without me telling you what to do with your day, enjoying the metaverse.
In addition to our listeners checking out your book, The Reasonable Robot, where else would you suggest that they take a look to learn more about your work, to keep up with the developments of Dabus and the like?
Well, anyone who's interested in the test cases, I operate a website, artificialinventor.com, which when I get to it, updates someone on the cases going around the world, but it is pretty up to date. And on me personally, my website is ryanabbott.com, or I'm at Dr. Ryan Abbott on Twitter or on LinkedIn, and would love to hear from anyone who has an interest in this.
Thank you, Ryan. We'll be sure to have a look.
Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed my conversation with Professor Ryan Abbott. Since we spoke, there have been some news regarding the Artificial Inventor Project, in that the Federal Court of Australia issued their decision in the appeal to allow an AI system to be named as a patent inventor. The panel held that only a natural person can be an inventor, so there are plans to appeal to the High Court. If you would like to learn more about this fascinating topic, his book, The Reasonable Robot, published by Cambridge University Press, can be found through all major book channels, including an audio version. For more books about IP-related topics, check out the Knowledge Repository at the WIPO Knowledge Center. Until next time, and the next page points, bye for now.